Okay, case will be taken under advisement. We're going to go on to case 4, which is 072127, United States versus Olson. Thank you. Hello, Mr. Habermehl. How are you?
Fine, thank you. That was interesting, the last one, yes. Again, my name is Alan Habermehl. I represent Mr. Olson. We're here on appeal. There are the two issues to briefly deal with the Commerce Clause issue. As always, I found myself wrestling trying to reconcile the various Supreme Court pronouncements on this, but I believe I've distilled a rule that's applicable. It seems to me from what the Supreme Court has said that there are two circumstances where Congress can regulate interstate commerce in the area of the criminal law. One is if the thing itself that's moving in interstate commerce is illegal to possess. That would be like a gun that's heading towards a felon or marijuana that's heading towards anyone. And the other kind of thing that can be, I think, under the Commerce Clause regulated would be even if you use a thing which itself is not illegal to possess, but then you use that thing which has already traveled in interstate commerce to then commit a crime which directly and substantially affects interstate commerce, then Congress can reach that crime by means of the use of the thing.
If we ignore the medium of a videotape or DVD and consider child pornography to be the commodity at issue, how would this case be distinguished from Wickard, where the commodity was weed, and Ratch, where the commodity was marijuana?
Well, I don't see how you can have child pornography without it appearing on a media, so I'm having a little trouble understanding the question, to be honest.
But how does that cut for your argument? Okay. Because if child pornography really is sort of inextricably associated with the medium, then certainly the medium moved in interstate commerce, and this court in Engel saw Congress's interest in regulating that particular market.
I appreciate the point. I understand Engel. That's obviously a difficulty. One issue, though, is that the two offenses are substantially different in that particular regard. I'm not dodging your question, but it needs two parts of an answer. Okay. The first offense does not involve the medium. It involves the activity of recording the sexual act. Literally, under that statute, a person could record the act and then immediately erase the tape, but you will still have committed the crime. It does not require any preservation of the medium, nor does it require possession.
That sounds to me almost like an overbreadth argument. That's not what happened here.
No, he did not actually.
He didn't record and then instantly erase.
But I'm not raising that as an overbreadth. This isn't a First Amendment thing. I realize this activity is not entitled to First Amendment protection. I would never argue that it is.
How did the images get onto his computer?
Pardon me?
How did the images get onto Olson's computer?
The images that formed the basis for count two were certainly obtained through the Internet. There's no doubt about that. I agree with that.
Would that be enough to solve any Commerce Clause problem if it was via the Internet?
No, because there's a lack of commercial activity there. Not all activity that goes interstate is commercial activity, and I don't think you could reasonably state that it was. In any event, again, it does require careful parsing. The first charge is of the activity of essentially taping the sexual assault. But again, that's the example of using an innocent item, I guess is what I'd call it, to borrow words from forfeiture law, namely the tape, to tape the activity. But it's the activity that's prohibited, as in the possession of the firearm in a school zone.
Not quite just the activity, though. It's the preservation, if you will, of that activity.
Okay. I wasn't being clear enough. It isn't the activity of the sexual assault. The activity I referred to specifically was the recording of the sexual act, as in the possessing of the gun in a school zone. But that activity, simply recording the act without more, has no discernible effect on commerce whatsoever. And again, under the statute, you could literally simply destroy the tape after having used it, but you would still have committed the crime.
But Congress has made the decision that when these acts become recorded onto some kind of medium, whether it's a video cassette or whether it's, you know, a digital record of some type, then they have a tendency to enter the market, whether by gift or exchange or sale, being rather unimportant.
Well, to say Congress has determined that, I believe overstates what Congress has actually done. Congress has made it illegal to do the videotaping. I see nothing in the statute where Congress has determined, in connection with that particular statute, that anything further is either likely to happen, which would affect interstate commerce, or is required to happen in order to invoke the statute. I think your assertion goes more to the second count, which, of course, is Engle, where the possessing of the pornography itself is the offense. And in that regard, again, I would liken that to several other of the cases where the Supreme Court has simply not accepted an assertion by Congress at face value that somehow it magically has an effect on interstate commerce just because they've chosen to make it illegal. The Engle Court, as I stated in the brief, was able to find one study from, I believe it was 1978, it's like 30 years old, in which there was some assertion that there is a larger market for pornography and that would be enough for a connection. But I believe under the Supreme Court...
You don't think that the facts would support such a congressional finding today? I mean, I don't want to take judicial notice of too much, but it's...
No, I don't think they do. It's perfectly possible for someone to simply possess that in their own private library with no intent whatsoever to distribute it further.
But the evidence in this case suggests that Mr. Olson was visiting websites that required exchanges, right?
That's true. On the other hand, he isn't charged with exchanging anything. Again, to keep the offenses clear, and this is a crime, and I believe we should make some effort to actually keep these things narrowly defined and clear so you know what is and isn't being prosecuted. He isn't charged. If he were charged with sending them over the Internet to someone else, I would certainly agree with you that that's regulable. But he isn't charged with that. He's charged with his own personal possession in the privacy of his own home of these admittedly incredibly obnoxious and awful images, but nonetheless, that's the only thing that triggers the statute, and that's the only thing he's charged with. You have to make the jump from his own private possession of something to the larger market in order to get it under the Commerce Clause, and I believe that's where Engle overstated it. I think they essentially did take judicial notice of something that there isn't enough of a factual record for. In any event, that's as much as I can distill on the Commerce Clause issue. On the sentencing issue, fundamentally, we have a case of putting new wine into old wineskins. And as I argued in the brief, when Congress changes the statute and actually increases the penalties, and the government, as it does, as it must, concedes that the new penalties can't be applied to the old offense, I don't see how you can nonetheless make the logical leap to say that the new guidelines, which were changed to match the new penalties, somehow apply to the old offense.
But the court did observe the old statutory minima and maxima.
Yes, it did.
And in Desmarais, we said these kind of ex post facto type arguments don't work in the post-Rita world. Post-Booker, post-Rita, post-everything, yeah.
It isn't so much a question of it being literally ex post facto as it is of simply being unreasonable. The judge, in applying the newer guideline, did not say anything about why she thought it was a better guideline than the older guideline or why the newer guideline should be applied to this old offense as opposed to the old guideline that was in effect when it was committed. She simply adopted it.
Well, she said she believed a sentence in the middle of the range would be appropriate.
She did, but that was after she had already calculated the range specifically and with great effort and detail by using the new sentencing guideline.
She seems to certainly be aware that she had discretion to use whatever number she
Yeah, I thought she said that she thought a very severe sentence would be appropriate.
While she has the discretion to do that, that discretion is based in part upon the advice given to her by the guidelines, and I believe it is essential if you're going to exercise your discretion based on advice from the guidelines that you first resolve the question of what are the real guidelines numbers. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, garbage in, garbage out. I mean, at a minimum, you should at least have the correct guidelines if you are going to turn around and say these guidelines appear appropriate to me. And the fundamental problem I have, and I believe this is a fundamental problem of fundamental fairness, and if anything is unreasonable, I think arbitrariness and unfairness must be. And that's that the sentence guidelines that were applied varied not because something different happened with regard to the offense in the intervening years, but simply because the guidelines changed. And it was a complete and total happenstance as to which of those guidelines would be applied to Mr. Olson, depending on when they finally got around to prosecuting him. And I can't, to be honest, for the life of me, see how that set happenstance, the mere lapse of some years between the offense and when he gets sentenced, followed by the change in guidelines, how those changed guidelines can have any relevance to any of the factors that should be applied to the offense, when the only thing that caused them was that the government waited long enough and they were able to take advantage of having a higher guideline. I do not mean intentionally they couldn't foresee that, but nonetheless, that's the effect of what occurred. And I don't see how that can have any relevance to the fundamental question, is what's the appropriate sentence for the offense when it happened. I see my time's up. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Tarros.
Thank you. The defendant really hasn't offered any compelling reason to overturn either Angle or Demaree in this case, and that's exactly what he's asking when he raises the two issues. In the first issue, dealing with the Commerce Clause, he wishes this court to overturn Angle, which has already used a market theory to say that somehow, that rather, excuse me, that because there's a substantial interest in regulating the child pornography industry, and there is a rational relationship between a prohibition on intrastate either production or possession of that material, that somehow it should not be allowed to occur because of the compelling interest. In addition, under Demaree, the court, as this court has ruled, those guidelines are advisory and has every reason to basically use the guidelines as advisory, which the court did in this case, and gave a sentence within the statutory boundaries. So there's really no reason on either theory. Just to go back under the Commerce Clause and under Raich, which the defendant does not really address, the Raich decision coming forward afterwards talks about a large-scale, comprehensive effort by Congress to regulate the child pornography industry, basically to eliminate it.
But, Mr. Jarrus, suppose Congress had passed a law saying anyone who uses sheets of paper that moved in interstate commerce, you know, there are big paper manufacturing plants in Wisconsin, and there are other states that don't have any paper manufacturing plants. If you use paper that moved in interstate commerce to write a pornographic novel or something, you know, that was capable of being regulated addressed to children, or you figure it out. What I'm trying to think of is there any other area in the law that you can think of that the medium itself is susceptible to hundreds of lawful uses, like the paper or like the blank CDs or whatever it is he was using, little flash drives, and yet when it gets put to one unlawful use, all of a sudden that is a federal hook for prosecuting that particular unlawful act. Where there's so many other ways you could prosecute child porn. You can prosecute receipt, you can prosecute manufacture of, you can prosecute all sorts of other things about it. And I can't believe that Wisconsin thinks that this is such a great thing either, so it probably violates state law as well. But why isn't this like my paper hypothetical?
Well, and I think that's interesting. And to the point that if you look at Raich and you look at the 11th Circuit's decision in Maxwell, what you really find is the implication of Raich is that jurisdictional hook, the jurisdictional hook that was missing in Lopez and that probably appeared in this case because of the desire to make sure there was a Commerce Clause hook in there, that interstate nexus hook, probably under Raich and exemplified by the Maxwell decision in one of the footnotes, is that may not even be necessary in and of itself anymore. We may not even need that if Congress has deemed and attempted to regulate the entire area. And when they reach out to regulate that entire area, which they have done in the child pornography area, if you look at the statute, you can't advertise, you can't possess it, you can't distribute it, you can't, goes on nauseam.
Right.
But the point is that once Congress attempts and goes into that area, then the jurisdictional hook, I would suggest, even under your example, becomes somewhat irrelevant. because
so Congress was just doing belt and suspenders somehow. It could have just said, look, we're regulating child pornography just like we're regulating growing wheat or we're growing.
I would respectfully suggest that's exactly what they could have done. And as such, you know, whether the paper or whatever it is, essentially becomes somewhat irrelevant. In this case, there is a jurisdictional hook. It is the interstate medium or the travel of the medium, which
it's
we
It's a very unsatisfactory hook to me. I mean, it seems so unrelated to the substance of what's being, in fact, targeted by this statute.
Well, and it may be an unsatisfactory hook, and it may be something that they decided, gosh, we better put that in there. But it doesn't mean that Congress overstepped its bounds under the Commerce Clause in outlawing either this conduct or the conduct that the defendant did in this case, because it certainly had the power and it certainly could say to itself, gosh, if we left the interstate production or the interstate possession unregulated, that's going to undermine our entire desire to basically control the market in child pornography. And it's rational for Congress to then decide that it needs to step in and regulate it, because leaving it unregulated would undermine its goals. Again, under the ex post facto, under Demery, I think that decisions are advisory guidelines. The court certainly used them as advisory, followed the statutory means, and I'd ask this court to affirm the district court's conviction and order of judgment. Unless there's any other questions, I have nothing more to say. Thank you.
Mr. Habermill, do you want to use Mr. Jarosz's extra minute?
Sure. Why not?
You probably traveled up here together.
Simultaneously. Again, two very quick things then. With regard, again, to the Commerce Clause, I do believe this is more like the arson case where the federal government tries to make it a federal crime by saying the gasoline in the car that you drove to go or maybe used to torch the place with itself traveled interstate commerce, and therefore whatever you do with it is regulable by Congress. That would be count one, the taping of the activity. And again, on count two, I don't believe that all activities of possessing something just because it came in interstate commerce are regulable, because the travel in interstate commerce had stopped while the item was still innocent. It came to Wisconsin as a videotape or a computer hard drive or whatever, and there was nothing wrong with it. What was done with it happened intrastate, and there is no demonstration that it has any substantial direct effect on interstate commerce whatsoever. In short, what's happens in Wisconsin stays in Wisconsin. I think that's the difference between what is and isn't regulable. There must be some limit or the Commerce Clause means nothing. Very quickly on the pornography thing, I don't think it's true that Congress can just regulate that just by saying pornography is a problem, therefore we can regulate the whole issue, that they can do so in a means which violates the restrictions of the Commerce Clause. The fact is, again, if they wanted to charge Mr. Olson with advertising for child porn, they could have done that. If they wanted to charge him with either receiving it or transmitting interstate commerce, they could have done so. They chose to charge him simply with possessing the medium itself, and that's a different crime, and I think it's outside the reach of Congress. Thank you.
Mr. Habermill, thank you. As usual, you did the fine job that you do, and you were court appointed, and we really appreciate your work. Well, and Mr. Rose, we appreciate you too. So thank you.